There was a very interesting thing that was a campaign that's been put forward by Choice around the announcement that Bunnings, Kmart, and Goodfellows wants to use facial recognition technology. That brings up a whole range of issues, doesn't it? This whole concept of privacy and other kind of freedoms that people might find quite challenging. You use that as one of the papers, that challenge that Choice has put forward as part of your analysis of the need for legislation or rules around facial recognition use. Can you talk to us about that kind of everyday situation that would confront Australian citizens?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing that is most common when you talk to Australians and people in the street about facial recognition is that, I guess, up until this Choice investigation, most people are really just thinking about using facial recognition to unlock their smartphone or perhaps their work device, in order for that convenience factor. A lot of people up until this investigation didn't realize just how many other businesses or shopping centers or even law enforcement are using facial recognition in other ways, from a security perspective, those sorts of things that raise really significant concerns for privacy, particularly in the absence of any legal protections, specifically in Australia, around facial recognition technology.
Now, there's some ideas around the usefulness of facial recognition. Can you talk to us about why it's considered to be useful?
Yeah, so I guess similar to some of the context, I was just saying that it can be really quick and simple. Instead of having to remember a lot of different passwords on your own personal devices, if you're the one that's programmed, your smartphone to unlock with your face, then you've got that choice and you've got that control and you've got that ease of access. Additionally, there's some other really positive uses of facial recognition being trialed, like to find missing children or in other humanitarian circumstances. I know it was trialed in some different places during the bushfires in Australia for people who had lost legal documents in the fire that they could have their identity verified through facial recognition. And even for people with disability, we can see that some types of facial analysis can be really useful to identify emotions in friends around them, potentially if they're blind or if they have a vision impairment. So there are some really positive and innovative uses of this technology, and we want to balance that innovation whilst protecting from the potential harms of other uses.
We probably should go through the difference between facial verification, facial analysis, and facial detection.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Yeah, no, that's right. So in our model law report, we try to, I guess, create a bit of a discussion around these three different types of facial recognition because they are quite different. So as you've just said, we've got facial verification, which is what some people call one-to-one. So that's what you'd use on your smartphone, where your phone has a stored blueprint of your face and just your face. And when you open it or use your face to open your phone, it's just matching against the picture of yourself. So that's the verification
And
type.
that's just that's the same for passports, right?
Yeah, that's right. So in different contexts, when you're, at the smart gate, and they're checking against your passport photo and your face, when you're walking through. Yeah.
And the other one,
And the second type, the second type of facial recognition, we call facial identification. So that's what can also be called one to many. So potentially the police might have a photo of someone who's committed a crime or someone who's stolen something, and they're matching that face against a huge database of other faces of other potential suspects. So naturally, the risks there increase because you're bringing in a whole lot of other different identities into the field there. And then I guess the third case, that's right, yeah. So analysis is really interesting, and it's really experimental as well still. This is where the face recognition technology is actually trying to infer something about you because of what it can see in your face. So that might be, you know, your gender or your age. It might be able to, you know, analyze your racial background or even things like emotions. And so there's a lot of concern because this technology is quite quite basic and definitely not proven. And it's also quite error prone for people who are from different racial backgrounds, people who have disability as well. So that's an area that we're quite concerned about.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the thing about using computers to come up with outcomes in this way, people feel that they are, what is it, can't be challenged because they're not human, they're better than human, as it were, in analysing things. But actually there are elements around this technology which make it not foolproof. It's not foolproof at all.
Yeah, that's right, Annie. So what you were kind of describing there is a term some people use, technology deference, where people go, oh, but it's a computer, it's an algorithm that's making this, you know, this analysis or this decision, and therefore it has to be right. But as we know, when you stop to think about it, well, actually, all computer programs and algorithms and facial recognition systems are developed by humans, and you know, humans are fallible as well, and systems, you know, improve and develop over time, but they're definitely not always accurate. And so it is really important that we start having conversations around, you know, how data is being tested or where it's being, you know, accrued from, that inform these complex decision-making systems.
Yeah, and you found, looking at all this documentation from across the world, that despite the fact that the algorithms and the software are increasingly becoming more sophisticated, they still have particular problems with women, people of colour, and disability, people with disability. That's fascinating, isn't it? Because that correlates with people who often are discriminated in our society.
Yeah, I know. It's a really sad truth, actually, that some of these technologies, such as facial recognition, are often used in contexts where, you know, they're being used on people who are already vulnerable, already discriminated against. And when the technology is less accurate for those individuals, that's when you've got a whole, you know, list of potential human rights risks. So just, you know, by way of example, there was a case a couple of years ago in Detroit in the US where police were using facial recognition to try and identify a criminal suspect, and the technology actually identified the wrong individual, and he was a, you know, an African American man, you know, with black skin, and we know that these cohorts of individuals are often much more, you know, policed and patrolled anyway, and so that actually led to a false arrest of an individual.
This is just an aside. I used to teach, and I used to teach a lot of people from different backgrounds, you know, from South America right across Pakistan and a whole range. And I found that I had a special gift. I could actually identify the people in my classes. And but one of the things that was odd to me was that I had a confusion about two people, and because they had such similar faces. One of them was from Pakistan and one was from Chile, which I thought was, it taught me a lesson that around, and it makes, that's why I found the facial recognition thing very interesting, because I wondered if computers have the same problem.
That is really interesting. And yes, I mean, I guess what we've found that up until this point, these technologies have traditionally been, well, I guess the ones that are being used in Australia and Europe and the States have been developed by predominantly white individuals, and often, you know, white men working in Silicon Valley or other kind of tech hubs around the world. And the data that the technology is being trained on is not representative of the whole world and doesn't take into account that diversity and those nuances between between humans. And I think that also kind of speaks to the nature of the facial recognition technology as well, is that the human face is so special for a number of different reasons. You know, it's not only, you know, your unique kind of biometric identifier that you can't change very easily, unlike a password, but it's also how we relate human to human and how we, you know, understand how we're feeling and those sorts of things. So there's a whole range of different issues all caught up in the facial recognition conversation.
Let's have a look at the model law that you're talking about, and around the issues that you believe you need to contend with in order to have some fairness in this.
Yeah, so coming to the model law exactly, we've tried to come up with a framework that can mean that Australia would be able to benefit from the good uses of the technology and also protect Australians from those negative risks. And the way that we've done that is through a risk assessment process, which ultimately would determine, you know, whether each different use is base or elevated or high risk. And then from that, there'd be different sorts of legal requirements that stem from that.
Which is very similar to an OH&S risk analysis arrangement.
Yeah, that's right. There's a number of different areas where, you know, in regulation or other kind of policies where the risk-based approach is what we're quite used to, because, you know, it's a bit more nuanced than putting blanket bans on particular uses. It means that we can actually start having a bit more of a sophisticated conversation about all these different types of the technology.
Well, I actually wrote down something from your report, but a risk-based approaches to regulation can help manage uncertainty across systems as a whole, rather than dealing with individual cases of harm after they have occurred.
Absolutely. That's a really good point that you've pulled out there. And that was really what I guess drove us to come up with this approach, is that we, and as has already been, you know, the case around the world, is that we're already seeing harms come from the use of facial recognition technology. And as this technology is becoming more and more ubiquitous and more rolled out around Australia and around other parts of the world, we don't want to get to a point where all of these harms are occurring and we're responding to them after they've happened. So by mitigating the risks and taking that sort of approach, we're making sure that we can stop those harms before they're occurring.
You have an example in the report around the notion that some software that's been developed in, you know, laboratory conditions, as it were, even they will come up with, say, 0.01% error. And if in the real world that is amplified, so the example you give, if they're going through the airport in Sydney and they make that kind of a level of error, say a million people go through there, and that would equal 10,000 people with a significant error involved. So there are things that need to be dealt with, even if it is an efficiency tool. Your analysis is a risk-based approach tied to international human rights law. So can you talk to that?
Yeah, so when we were doing our research for putting together this law, we'd spent a lot of time early on looking at what was, you know, perhaps had been tried in other parts of the world around facial recognition. And I guess the different approaches that some countries are taking is either the, you know, do nothing approach, which is sort of similar to what Australia has done up until this point, where we've got a number of existing laws, such as the Privacy Act, that aren't specifically tailored to facial recognition, but, you know, they cover some of the issues there. So, I mean, that's one approach. You know, the next approach is just a moratorium or a blanket ban on the use of facial recognition in different contexts. But what we were trying to do is say, okay, there's actually a better way of doing this by creating a specific law, and how should we frame that? And, you know, I come from a human rights background, and so does another one of our co-authors, and we found that this framework is actually a really robust way of looking at the opportunities and the risks, and also a way of doing it that this could in fact be adaptable in other parts of the world as well. And so we were, you know, throughout our consultation process, we've involved a number of different international voices, and the language of human rights and international human rights law is something that is you know, recognised globally. And so in terms of having a law that could be applied to different jurisdictions, it's been a good way forward.
Well, it's really very interesting because, of course, doing policy and doing laws and is a very practical thing. And as you point out, privacy isn't an absolute human right. So what you're talking about is trading off levels of human right.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And we sort of talk about that in the model law, is that when we were coming up with our risk levels, there's no such thing as a zero risk use of facial recognition. We call the bottom, you know, the least risky version as a base level risk, because as you say, there's always going to be a trade off. Usually with privacy when you're using facial recognition. So there should always be some base level protections that are embedded in any kind of system, even if the facial recognition is, you know, it's fairly low risk.
And if we go back to the issue of Kmart, Bunnings and Goodfellas, you have this distinction about outcomes for individuals that have legal ramifications or have basic infringements on their freedom.
Yeah, so I guess what you're talking to there is the kind of the nuts and bolts of how the model law would work. And so we've come up with there's about five different key elements that we think are really crucial for developers or deployers of this technology and what they need to think about before they develop the technology or, you know, use it on Australians. So this idea of the spatial context of where the technology is going to be used, is it going to be in the public? Is it for personal use? The type of facial recognition. So there's three different types of what we were talking about before, where facial verification is lower risk, definitely lower risk than identification or facial analysis. And we've also got to take into account things like the performance of the technology. And again, like you were just saying, whether or not there's an actual decision and particularly a legal or a similarly significant decision being made about an individual.
And also consent. You talk a lot about open and clear consent from the people that it's being done to.
Absolutely. Yeah. And consent often comes up time and time again as being one of the really pivotal areas of this conversation. And that's where we can see with Choice and with Bunnings, where there was such a big problem, because whilst they were saying, oh, look, we, you know, we did put up a notice, it was in the, you know, in the corner on your way in, that's not really real consent. You know, just being able to notify someone without a guarantee that they've actually read that information and been able to make an informed decision about whether or not they want to engage with that technology, you know, that's not real consent. So we've had a lot of conversations in our consultation around the idea of giving really free and informed consent. And if you don't want to consent to using that technology, then you shouldn't be, you know, discriminated against or have any kind of a detriment. You should still be able to access goods and services in other ways if you don't want to engage with the facial recognition.
Just as a matter of interest, do you know why they wanted to do facial recognition?
My understanding is that I mean, I think there are a few different reasons. My understanding is that it was a loss or a theft prevention mechanism for some of these commercial entities. So, you know, I guess the next stage up from the old-fashioned, you know, watch out for this customer kind of thing, because they've, you know, tried to shoplift in the past and having, you know, a picture behind the front counter, that this was actually being used instead as a way to identify, you know, problem customers. But again, that might have been different from organisation to organisation.
The What was it? Clearview AI, is that the name of the company in America? That
Yeah, that's right.
that's a very interesting case study where they actually scraped a whole lot of images from Facebook and other social media outlets. Makes you wonder what, and it was disallowed without anybody's consent for them to have, because they were creating a bank of images. It makes you wonder the bank of images for Kmart, Bunnings, and Goodfellas is. Or are they actively
Yeah, that's
collecting
right. I
it?
mean, there are definitely a lot of questions around what was in that database and whether that they were images that they had collected previously from customers or whether they were using another security tool. Yeah, there's not a lot of clarity out about that.
But you're calling for the Attorney General to take some steps, aren't you? You think that that would be a good way to go?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, that's been a big part of this whole project since we started at the beginning of the year, was making sure that we were bringing everyone along on the journey, at least keeping them informed. And we've had a lot of conversations with government departments and also members of parliament throughout the process. And ideally, we think it's really necessary that the government takes this forward as a pivotal reform agenda, really. There's also a separate process of review underway at the moment with the Australian Privacy Act, and so we think that this could actually fit in quite nicely with that process. But absolutely, we think that with the amount of speed with which this technology is evolving, it's really crucial that the government takes this seriously and comes up with some new and robust laws for Australia.